I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast.
The year is 1969. The album is Tadpoles. The band is a Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. My guest is Jeffrey Weissman. Thank you for inviting me into, well, your friend's home.
It's my pleasure.
This is fun. This is fun. So we met through, I did the Million McFly March last year, and you do all kinds of Back to the Future related charities.
Yes, because I took over the role of George McFly in part two and part three. Mm-hmm. I thought, how can I give back to the amazing international fan base and these movies? So I produced a fundraiser for Michael's charity under the auspice of Team Fox. It produced a cruise to raise money and put a band together made up of former cast members of Back to the Future films. And we raised about $8,000 our first try and about $1,000 for We Spark, which is Wendy Jo Sperber, who played Linda McFly, who's passed away, but she set up a cancer support center here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's so good. That cruise looked like so much fun. I was so jealous every time I looked at the
photos. Oh, it was a blast. Yeah. Well, you mentioned that you had gone to sites that Back to the Future movies were shot at, and the day you did your Million McFly March was the, I think we're into the fifth or sixth day of another fundraiser for the Parkinson's Foundation called We're Going Back.
Yes.
Ken Kapowski out of Canada, Joe Walser out of LA, produced this event where all these, I think they had 250 fans every day going to each one of the locations that we shot the original scenes at.
That's awesome.
From all over the world. Mm-hmm. They were thrilled. They were just sort of orgasmic for these Back to the Future nerds. It was just delightful because we would have cast members, crew members at those locations to tell behind-the-scenes stories or sign autographs. Or that we took over the town of Fillmore and you could hoverboard. the flux capacitors played. It was really a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
It was awesome.
So then through there, after sort of realized, I mean, to be fair, you showed up to give me some, you were kind enough to give me some things for the McFly March.
Yeah, it was totally cool that you were doing it.
You showed up dressed as Charlie Chaplin, so I'm like, this is a guy I want to talk to on my podcast. I'm like, holy, not only, like, you drove over just in full regalia, and I'm hoping maybe not in the floppy shoes, but I could be wrong.
I try not to drive in those shoes, but sometimes I do. It's a little dangerous for the others on the road. I'm okay still. But I guess I had just come from a gig.
And so you picked a band that I've wanted to do forever. In fact, like, a good friend of mine has all their albums, and he's like, why haven't you talked about the Bonzos on the show before? And
what's up with that?
Nobody's brought it up. You brought it up. So,
well, I originally wanted, you said, well, something that you loved, and I immediately went through the, oh my God, the maze of albums through my childhood.
I
remember having a 78 of Bill Cosby because he played at my dad's club. Where he's a football player, his skin gets stuck to the seat, and his jersey gets into the game. That was great. I had a demo version of that; hadn't even been released yet.
Oh my God!
Dad got from Bill at his club, and inherited from my parents' collection or my older brother and sisters. I had Examining Doctors by May Nichols. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, let's do Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And I can't even find my copy of Examining Doctors now.
Oh, no.
And you said, well, what other, you know, and there's, you know, I went to the committee 50-year reunion, got Gary Goodrow, who just passed away, got him to sign the Broadway album.
Wow.
Here, and Alan Meyerson was there, and Howard Hessman, all these greats. I was like, well, I could do that, I love the Bonzo Dog Band. I was in 73... visiting the original Renaissance Fair up in Agoura.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these guys who used to have this game called Tulsiwup,
okay,
where you get on a log with someone else and that you have a basically a big pillow, but it's pretty heavy, and you try to knock each other off the log, right? And it was Doug and Mike. I can't even remember their names. But they were, you know, hippies, but really sweet guys who produced a fantasy fair. I remember in Hollywood at the Palladium, it was the first fantasy fair, the first time you'd see a laser being bounced off the next building over from the parking lot, and they had Bulgarian female choir and this unusual band called the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo.
That's so good.
All these really great bands at this fantasy fair, and they were truly unique fellows. And because I lived at the fair site for a while as a gypsy myself, I would see them often. And one day they were walking down the dirt path and were singing this song. Oh, the parson's eyes are glistening and the children are all listening, for the stork has brought a son and daughter for Mr. and Mrs. Mickey Mouse. Pluto's throwing a party, but before the fun begins, he'll award a gold Madonna to the father of the twins. Hooray, hooray, it's a public holiday. A million, million people are happy, bright, and gay. Bells are ringing in the steeple, but is that public holiday? So the stork has brought a son and daughter for Mr. and Mrs. Mickey Mouse. I was like, well, what is that? And they looked at each other and said, you don't know the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band? I said, no. And then they went in and started riffing on Shirts.
Oh, my God.
Shirts. Here comes a strange little lady with a kangaroo. Madam, what do you think of Shirts? Oh, I don't know so much about that. They knew all these lyrics of these avant-garde, irreverent songs and comedy sketches. Mm-hmm. I was like, what is the Bonzo Dog Band? And over the years, I got to pick up some records after hearing Urban Spaceman on the radio and getting to know them, and then research them and found that they had been the house band on an early TV show. Mm-hmm. Don't touch that dial.
Do not adjust your television. Jesus Christ, I have it written down. Pardon my French.
That had three of the Monty Python members.
Do not adjust your set.
God. Terry Jones, yes. Eric Idle.
And Palin, right?
Michael Palin.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had this sort of auspicious beginning, like many great bands, like the Talking Heads and so many others, Devo, that came out of art school. Mm-hmm. They were all in art school together. The Beatles were in art school together. And they formed this, they weren't skiffle, they were more, I think, Dixieland type.
Right.
Jazz. They were a jazz ensemble.
Which is so weird to me.
Yes. Well, then they found, with jazz, you learn the elements of comedy improvisation.
That's true. Right, right, right.
And their irreverent leader, Vivian Stanchel, had such a dry, tongue-in-cheek, attitude in his voice. It was like, everything's all so droll and everything. And you hear him, one of my favorite cuts of all theirs is the intro and the outro. Mm-hmm. Have you listened to that?
I have not, and you mentioned it, and listen. I just read about it.
It's so magnificent, because it's all it is from start to finish is introductions of the band members. And there's everyone from Roy Rogers on Trigger to Count Basie and his orchestra on Triangle. You know, and they give a little example, Eric Clapton on ukulele, and oh, that's wild, Eric. You know, it's this real...
Wait a minute. Now I think I might have heard it. Because, I mean, in the early days of thinking it was okay to steal MP3s, I stole a lot of Bonzo Dog stuff. And so, but then I lost it, so I know I've heard that. Now,
there's instant karma for you for stealing.
I know.
You.
Yeah, believe me.
But now, I mean, what do you... You can find them in the used record bin for very little now.
Most of my albums are 50 cents. It's normally how cheap I get them, because I don't, you know...
God bless the Goodwill and the Salvation Army.
So true.
Though, you know, to find them in mint condition, you're starting to pay $10, $15 a piece.
Yeah, sure.
But they're so wonderful. And you can find most of the songs now on YouTube. Mm-hmm. They've been posted. I even named my home after one of their songs. They did a cover of a song I believe was originally from the 20s called Jollity Farm. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just a up-tempo kind of foxtrotty, happy song. You know, all the cats meow, all the dogs bow wow here on Jollity Farm. And there's a couple different versions on YouTube you can find. And and that's just, it's delightful music. It's a celebratory and then often irreverent and so absurdly funny. Kind of makes you go cross-eyed. So through the years, not only becoming a fan, but I DJ too. Mm-hmm. And a gentleman that I know up in Northern California who was a pirate radio on a barge off of the UK, off English coast, has a radio show up there. And he invited me on knowing what a fan I am because he got Roger Ruskenspear on the phone.
Oh, that's so good.
And we were on the phone with him for over an hour.
That's awesome.
And he was reminiscing up the yin yang. He had just been touring, starting to tour with three bonzos and a piano.
Uh-huh.
And his follow-up record has even the sequel to Shirts.
Really?
Yes, it's called awesome. Shirts 2010.
Hello. Well, that was the sound of Roger's wah-wah rabbits. You heard them eating endive there. That's very cheap at this time of the year. But now, here in Willesden Green, yes, it is a bit chilly, but no matter, because here comes a gentleman, and we're going to talk to him about shirts. Excuse me, sir, would you mind talking to us about shirts?
Do what?
About shirts.
Shirts?
Yes.
I've got plenty of time.
Good grief. And here comes a lady with an enchanting little kangaroo. And I'm going to ask her something about shirts. No, I'm not. Because she's given me rather a vulgar sign. Would you mind with talking about shirts?
Huh?
About shirts.
Shirts?
Yes, the problem of shirts. The kind of, are they necessary? Shirts.
There it is.
Where it is, yes. Where is Shirts?
I don't know.
I don't know.
And a lot of the songs are very similar, even though we don't have Vivian Stanchel anymore. Mm-hmm. Roger Ruskenspear, who had this whole concept of having a wardrobe orchestra.
Uh-huh.
You'll see one of the Bonzo's tunes is called The Trouser Press.
Uh-huh.
And he would build these robots in his garage, and often they were made out of, I don't know, dry cleaning machines or... You know, press, a trouser press. He actually made the trouser press into a musical instrument.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, they were art students, you know, and he'd get calls. He had these wonderful stories. In fact, I'll share the show with you, and you can use excerpts if you like.
Oh, great, yeah.
Where he would be opening for rock bands, you know, Mott the Hoople or Slade or whoever, you know, back in the day, mm-hmm. and he would have his robots on stage just... doing their strange things, and their avant-garde music. And, you know, most of the hippies back then were probably really stoned or on acid, and it was just perfect for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, what the fuck am I watching? twist the brain. And you know, the Renaissance fair that I spoke about, where I learned about the Bonzo, it was pretty big drug culture. Mm-hmm. So it was perfect for those guys to be discovering Bonzo Dog Band, because the Ren Faire is very Anglo-centric.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, here in the States, for the hippies in comedy, it was Firesign Theater.
Sure.
Dave Osman came out of the early Renaissance fairs.
Yeah, you said that. That's interesting.
Phil Proctor was around then. And so the natural kind of progression, since it was Elizabethan England, is After Hours. Well, let's get some contemporary English fun in here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, be on the fringe and... other English humor was, you know, was good, but it seemed a little too conservative, whereas these right. guys were hippies and irreverent.
Yeah.
So it made sense. It's all in the equation.
What's crazy is later today, I'm going to be talking about some of the more conservative English music, and even maybe some of the more staid English comedy with the album we picked. So this is a perfect...
juxtaposition.
Thank you. There's the word that I couldn't think of.
or is it juxtaposition?
Juxtaposition.
Here's one.
There's one.
There's a nice gesture.
Yeah, listening to it, I was just like, well, first of all, you telling me that, I'm like, that's just amazing that they might have been hurting nerds' brains just a little bit before Monty Python, that they might have just been needling yeah. our brains before.
Well, if you were like a liberal or democratic or rebelling conservative teen in the mid to late 60s, you know, and the flower power was coming on, and the hippie movement was evolving, or you stayed in your bedroom until you were old enough to run away from home and become emancipated,
mm-hmm.
You were probably dropping acid or getting stoned, yeah. you know, on the sly, and you had, you know, your little record player. What did you have to play? Well, some of these, you know, trippy records that, you know, Frank Zappa and the Mothers were, in my opinion, doing... sort of like what the Bonzo Dog Band were doing,
yeah.
only stateside, where they were just freaking out, being very creative with this improvisational jazz stuff that Frank was leading them in. And it's really, you know, We're Only in It for the Money and Freak Out and Susie Cream Cheese, all those early records are trippy as hell. Mm-hmm. And if you were buzzed and listening to it, or late at night, you know, looking for entertainment where you didn't have to go to mainstream television and watch the Beverly Hillbillies,
sure,
or whatever,
sure.
You know, you had this outlet. And yeah. So for the English kids, Bonzo Dog Band, for the American kids, the Frank Zappa and the Mothers, and I don't know. This is, I'm just kind of figuring it all out in retrospect.
Well, it's crazy, too, that these guys were the connection between the Beatles and Monty Python, essentially, too.
Yeah.
Because Urban Spaceman, which is probably the first Bonzo song I ever heard and loved it, didn't get it because I was a little too young to get it, I think. I still don't think I entirely get it. But that was half produced by Paul McCartney because he liked the Bonzo Dog Band.
Right, and then George Harrison connection with the Monty Python.
Yeah.
And producing their films. And
then it all comes together in Rutland Weekend Television. It's just like this, just it's very incestuous, but like three wonderful things that are like, I guess, making love. That's gross. But you know, you get my point.
It's a love fest. It's all relative.
And the whole time I'm listening to this, I'm like, wait.
Did you get that? It's incestuous. It's all relative.
Very good.
Come back with that.
I should have given it more credit than I did. Listening to it, I'm like, okay, so was New Vaudeville Band before or after? And I did not know that they were basically about the same time and that they mm-hmm. almost became the New Vaudeville Band. But then the New Vaudeville Band apparently stole their entire look and their all the like the design of their...
Oh, I didn't realize
that. Yeah, yeah, I just had read that. So the guy who made the New Vaudeville Band album with session musicians apparently came to Neil Innes and the rest of them and said, would you guys like to perform? When they said no, he stole their look and then just put together another
Well,
band.
It's a compliment. You know, it's always... imitation is a form of flattery. Yeah, that's what it is. Steal from the greats. That's what you find. And so were New Vaudeville Band, were they the ones that did Winchester Cathedral?
And the whole album is that, though.
Oh, boy.
There's no variety.
Stop like holding your nose and singing.
Exactly. That's all
Get
it is.
Get there! But the Bonzos did, though I grew up very much, kind of riding on my parents' tastes, and they had, mm-hmm. Besides Herb Alpert and, The Singing Nun and things like this, you know, growing up, they also had the Firehouse Five Dixieland Band. And if you listen to Bonzo stuff, they're doing Hello Central, Give Me Dr. Jazz with a more Waka Waka kind of feel to it.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, well, I know this music already.
That's perfect.
Yeah. It was kind of cool, fun. So it's kind of conservative, you know, respecting our elders.
Sure.
But then breaking ground, new territory, mm-hmm. and rock and roll. Because they did get into the rock and roll bent on it and had fun with that. And it's sort of still burlesquing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Vivian Stanchel was just amazing. Apparently he was terribly tortured and
really
had a bad end, etc. But you know, a lot of genius. Sid Barrett with Pink Floyd. Sure. You know, they had their demons and such. Vivian, I guess, just couldn't... I don't know. There is a great book out, apparently, on Vivian mm-hmm. Stanchel and the Bonzos. That,
oh, really?
That I recommend people seek it out, because I hear it's a great read.
That's awesome. Okay, so you did mention earlier, and I didn't want to let this go, that your father had a club. So,
yeah.
Nightclub, comedy club, both? What are we talking about?
It was a sort of a private gambling club.
Really?
Yeah. He had... either co-owned or managed various clubs, the LA City Club. He had his own club on Santa Monica in West Hollywood at La Cienega called the Regency. And then up on the Sunset Strip, the Savoy, which later became the Cavendish West, which I think is still extant,
really?
Up on the Strip. And mm-hmm. he was co-owners with Lauren Green.
Really?
On that one or one of the others. And then when I was a kid, I'd go visit the club, and I remember I got... kidnapped once by Checo Marx's widow.
What?
Hid under the table for hours. They didn't know where little Jeffrey was. And I would meet Omar Sharif, Don Adams. You know, a lot of, you know, stars would go and
sure.
play bridge or backgammon. And,
yeah.
And you know, the one time I think the club got raided by the DA, the DA, Bert Pines' mom, Ruth Pines, was part of the gang that got arrested, so you know, everyone got released and all the charges dropped because the DA's mother was part of the paddy wagon
gang.
Wow. Anyway, so the you know, it was a business that he got in, and my dad was always trying to get out of that business.
Sure, yeah.
Because of seeing actors drinking, gambling, and all, he didn't want me to become an actor at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he would ask, he came home one day and said, Jeffrey, I asked Don Adams some advice for you, since you say you want to be an actor. And he said, Wally, tell him to forget about it. It's 90% luck and 10% of, you know, talent and who you know. You know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it's needless to say, I couldn't get acting out of my system, and I continued. And I became very proud, first, of my dad for going back to school and getting his master's in psychology and becoming a psychologist. And and then he became very proud of me when he saw my name in the first movie I co-starred in, I think Twilight Zone movie with John Lithgow on George Miller's segment, and then other films. And so then later in his life, he became a drama therapist as well.
Really?
And I'd go down and coach him in improvisation and his scene work, and he would take drama therapy and Shakespeare and theater into jails.
Wow.
And help treat inmates, you know, rehabbing them with arts, with the dramatic arts and such. Well, I think he only got caught in one or two lockdowns.
That's good. Yeah. That's a good record. Oh, my God. That's fascinating to me.
Hey, I've been fascinated, too. I had it right here on the arm. I scratched it, got infected. So, I guess the introduction to comedy on vinyl came, I guess, through my dad. He not only had comedians play at his clubs and such, but he would regale me with stories of going to see, what's his name? Wanna Buy a Duck. Not Joe Besser, he was in the Stooges. I'll think about it, his name. But who used to play on the Sunset Strip a lot, and Don Adams was a stand-up. He turned me on to Bob Newhart. You know, all the stand-ups that made it into television. And I would have this awareness, you know, Red Fox, I know, came from stand-up, but his albums are like filthy.
On the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed. I've got everything I need.
Also was a bail bondswoman before she switched careers, and she bailed Lenny Bruce out of jail twice. And as well as Winston Churchill's daughter, you know, for pot charges. Anyway, so the second time Lenny and my dad's best friend Burton Marks was his attorney, and we got Lenny out of jail, my sister and I were in the car, and Lenny said, I go score some shit, you know, and because he swore in front of the children, she would never bail him out again.
Oh.
You know, so she had her standards. You know.
I love it. Oh, my God.
But so I grew up, I guess, with this mystique around, you know, who's Lenny Bruce? Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as I was old enough to go listen to some of his recordings, I'm like, wow! And then the Dustin Hoffman movie, you know, came out.
Oh, my God.
It really was fun for me to sort of get a little inkling and preview of the adult world of comedy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, because I've been performing in comedy, I was in the Laugh Factory All-Star Improv Jam for a better part of a year and a half. A lot of those folk that I jammed with, Brad Sherwood from Whose Line Is It Anyway, Dan O'Connor, who's now with Impro Theater. We helped start Los Angeles Theater Sports 20-some years ago. And now they're still performing, but what they'll do now is take one suggestion and do a 3-hour Jane Austen or Tennessee Williams or Twilight Zone or Stephen Sondheim musical. And they are just amazing.
Wow.
They've honed their craft so beautifully. And it all comes out of this sort of stand-up but improvisation family that these albums are based on, you know, the mm-hmm. Nichols and May. It's so funny. I was shooting a film, kind of a grad student film one day, mm-hmm. and Sandy Baron shows up on set.
I don't know that name.
He was on Seinfeld as the angry neighbor, stand-up comedian for years.
All right.
And I'm like, and you know, he's on oxygen by this time, you know, mm-hmm. and he's got his tank with him. I was like, Sandy Baron, what are you doing here? And he goes, well, you got a cute producer. I met her at the deli. Let me come with you to your film set. Maybe I can coach some of these kids. I was like, my God. And I told him about my idea of doing a documentary on the family tree of improvisation.
Yeah.
And he went on a rave. He was like, fuck the May and Nichols, Lenny Bruce. I was doing improv in the clubs years before any of them. The committee, I outdated them. I predated them. As jerks stole it from me. I wish I had one of these recorders to get this interview of Sandy Baron going through all that. It was so funny to hear his anger. You know, I should get the credit. It's like, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott saying Bob Dylan stole his whole act and got famous. It's the same type of thing.
Sure, sure.
It's all incestuous. But so this improvisation thing, mm-hmm. now, you know, I'm teaching it at university. Mm-hmm. And it's taught in schools. When I went to Australia 15, 20 years ago, in junior high and the high schools, the Keith Johnstonian impro, the theater sports type improv was being taught in the schools.
Wow.
It was very cool. And they had their own TV shows before Whose Line Is It Anyway? Yeah. Brought it to popularity in first the UK and then the States. And it really is a great tool now because I know facilitators and trainers who are taking it to these companies from high tech through sales and training people how to listen, because that's the key to great improv.
Right.
It's just, how do you listen and then add logically to the storytelling?
Yeah.
And it's really incredible tools. And now these guys like Dan O'Connor and Brian Lohman, who I sort of weaned on improv with, are now doing the TEDx talks.
Really?
On improvisation and such.
Really?
It's fun.
That's crazy. It's interesting, too, that it's all then based on, I mean, there's a reward system of laughter versus silence too, and that everybody must respond to that then if it's working.
Well, there's different forms of it, and I try to stay away from the gag prov or bar prov, where the laughter you're not going for the laugh, but mm-hmm. rather more of the storytelling.
Okay.
Because ultimately, even if it's a dramatic piece, it can be so fulfilling.
Sure,
can be so incredibly rewarding. And it takes a lot of trust because our natural tendencies across the board mm-hmm. are insecure and we want to please.
Yes.
And if you're doing it for someone else, you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah,
you have to do it for yourself and listen to the integrity and be respectful of the story is number one. And working at the top of your intelligence is exhausting.
Yes.
It's very hard. And doing all the things is a juggling act. But ultimately, if you look at the early committee work,
mm-hmm.
actually not the early, but all through the committees,
yeah.
they were working at the top of their intelligence, really bright, wonderful people, and they laid the groundwork and set the bar high at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I can't wait for Jamie Wright, who runs the San Francisco Improv Festival,
uh-huh.
is doing a documentary on the committee.
Oh, awesome.
And he got all the members that were alive and attending the 50-year reunion up there to mm-hmm. do interviews and then mixing it with the archive footage. It's going to be brilliant
when
it comes
great.
Out.
That's great. That's so good. You know, and the funny thing is, I don't know, you know, the Bonzos come out of this improv jazz thing. What's great, mm-hmm. we didn't even mention, is that there are actual, there's just sketches. I mean, the Shirts is a sketch.
Yes.
And it's fantastic. And I'm assuming it's improv.
It is. And it's pretty much a man on the street improv. Mm-hmm. They took it to the street, and what you hear is what they got, and it's so incredible, the responses from people on the street. I hope you'll play it.
Yeah. I will.
Is it on Tadpole? I think it is
on Tadpoles. Yeah. It's an interesting mix, this album.
Then listen to Shirts 2010.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear that. So, okay, but you also said, you know, because unfortunately I had to force you to pick one album. So this is the one where, like, all right, let's do this, because also it's the only one that I could find in terms of the MP3s that I have.
Mm-hmm.
So But there's some other. I mean, Urban Spaceman was one that you're a big fan of. Is there one?
Well, Urban Spaceman for them was their big hit here stateside, at least.
Sure, sure.
And it has a lot of political statement in it, and is up tempo, and it's a little rock and roll. It's where they're actually shifting a little out of the jazz and into the rocking part, and it's very witty and clever and such, and thus it got airplay. And you know, here's hippie comedy music.
Yeah.
And so we don't only have the Mothers of Invention, which don't fit into any AM or FM playlist format.
Right.
So I think Urban Spaceman, because it's sort of their pop hit, most people would know.
Yeah. So you first heard of them through these people quoting them at you. What did you just go out immediately and buy an album? Like, what was your...
No, I was pretty poor.
Yeah, okay. You did say you were living...
Yeah, I was doing a gypsy kind of life during those Ren Faire days. So I sort of filed it away. And whenever I would come across then, years later, a Bonzo Dog Doodah Band record, or I heard them on Dr. Demento or wherever, I would pay close attention, and finally became obsessed with finding a Mr. and Miss, the son and daughter for Mr. and Mrs. Mickey Mouse, and then discovered Jollity Farm, and discovered various other tunes that I had either heard of or heard parts of or were filed in my subconscious. So on Tadpoles, it wasn't really until a couple years ago that I re-listened to and rediscovered Hunting Tigers in Unja.
And I had never heard that till today. So,
and have you seen the video?
No.
Oh, go to YouTube and see the video. Okay. You'll see Vivian Stanchel's the star of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the original version, or the version you'll see on YouTube, is from the TV show.
okay.
Don't adjust your TV.
Do not adjust your set.
Do not adjust your set.
There we go.
And so it is kind of like a kids show sketch.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's fun as can be.
Mm-hmm.
It's really lovely. And, you know, they're in our pith helmet and being completely British and going out and hunting tigers in Africa. I mean, Indra. And you'll see it's just camp and silly fun.
Yeah.
And delightful.
Right.
So it is, yes, a kids show, but it's also adult. Like, George of the Jungle. You know, it was a cartoon for kids, but it had adult stuff in it. If you look closely, there's a lot of great humor in a lot of those cartoons that were kid-oriented, but very adult. So, saw Hunting Tigers out in Ninja Shirts. Let's see, Tubas in the Moonlight. Dr. Jazz is, like I mentioned, the Dixieland thing that I was familiar with.
Yeah.
Monster Mash, you know, is...
Yeah, they cover the Monster Mash.
Their version.
Album. It's great.
Began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
The monster mash.
It caught on in a flash.
The monster mash.
He did the monster mash. From the hall of gore in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abodes to get a jolt from my electrode.
He did the mash.
Did the monster mash.
And I almost brought it. I have Zacharel's version that he signed for me.
Really?
At the show in New Jersey in Parsippany. What do they call it? Chiller Theater. One of these fan cons.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was. I mean, is he still alive? He's probably about 98 now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you do have a lot of their albums sitting here, though. You did bring a lot of them.
Yeah. I have Gorilla, which I was hoping was the one that we were going to do.
Oh, shoot. Well, then that's my fault.
Well, no, it's no worries.
Next time.
But it has Jollity Farm, because that's what I call my home. It's a natural favorite, and it's so sweet. It's just a really sweet little... left my heart in San Francisco. Look out, there's a monster coming. It's very strange.
Look out, there's a monster coming.
Just, and the song Death Cab for Cutie is on this record.
Yeah.
which, yeah, as we know, is a band name.
But, right.
So they obviously, in that band, pay homage to the Bonzos. But the intro and outro is on this one, too.
Oh, okay. See, that's all right. And I feel Mickey's like I have heard them. And I did look up Mickey's Son and Daughter, mm-hmm, based on your recommendation, which is great.
And then they do their little, I'm bored, as opposed to Iggy Pop's I'm Bored, which is a pretty good song, too. Sound of Music on there. Anyway, Gorilla is just a fun one. And then this Urban Spaceman is different than Tadpoles. So strange that, yeah, that I would have this. And I'd be like, well, I have Urban Spaceman, but I don't have Tadpoles. How did that happen? And it has a whole slew of other songs. And then there's this sort of let's Make Up and Be Friendly, which was obviously an American compilation of probably tracks that, mm-hmm, just didn't have a home.
Yeah.
Like Rollinson End, you know, Turkey's King of the Scruff, Waiting for the Wardrobe's got to be a Roger Ruskin spear. Mm-hmm. You know, really fun stuff. I recommend, once again, seek out, find their book and get the history. And you'll see, you know, Neil Innes, of course, after the Ruddles, I don't think did but maybe one of the Bonzo reunions.
Oh, really?
Because he's got his own thing going, yeah, you know, and he tours, yeah, as Neil Innes and is very popular and yeah, successful. And whereas Roger Ruskin's spear will get to Larry Legg Smith and a couple of the other Bonzos who may still be alive. I think several of them have kicked. But we'll do these little reunions, and like I mentioned, three Bonzos and a piano, which I hope you play a cut of.
Okay, yeah. All right, I will.
You can download? You can upload maybe a couple of these?
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be
so as you can see, also, Roger Ruskin's spear has solo stuff out.
It's an insane cover. And these are the robots.
Those are the robots.
Wow. Yeah. Holy crap. That's fantastic. Man. Okay. So that's what's so funny to me, though, is that it stuck with you for so long before you actually heard it for real, before it was actually fun.
Yeah, because I was at a point where I was sort of, you know, rebelling from my parents. So I was out living on this fair site and looking for mentoring or guidance, yeah, and all of a sudden hear these hippie guys singing this ridiculous music that was really quite charming, mm-hmm, and there was, you could tell there was a lot of reverence and play, mm-hmm, and I was like, wow, and that stuck with me.
Yeah.
And then I saw what these guys were doing with their fantasy fair, and that stuck with me, and so then I would seek out the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo and find, mm-hmm, that they are, as you know, Oingo Boingo's music is just fun as can be.
Yeah.
And the whole Danny Elfman soundtrack stuff, you know, it's even though, once again, he steals from everyone. You hear Nino Rota from Fellini films, and you hear all these different places that he's stolen from, steal from the greats, sure, and imitate and celebrate the cinematic feel. So these albums, if you're an adolescent and you're in your bedroom and you can't get along with the folks, and you have these albums that are like little movies in your brain you can watch. You know, the thing with Cheech and Chong, you know, with creating these scenes, each one you can cinematically see them as they're being told or acted out. The, yeah, Fire Sign Theater stuff, Nick Danger, you know, it's you got these visuals when, you know, TV is just commercial garbage, and you had these escapes.
Right. So. What's great, too, about this is I noticed on the back that it says Dada for now. Apparently, they were originally going to be called the Bonzo Dog Dada Band, like, just be as literal as
Duda
possible. Yeah, yeah, but then Duda. They went to Duda.
Yeah.
Apparently, originally Dada, though. It was one apparent. This is it's a very hotly contested amongst the members of the group, even.
Oh.
But I just like that it's not just improv. It's also just, like,
Tristan Zara.
It's just insane. Yeah. It's just, they're not just playing, they're not just doing tribute, it's not just, like, tribute jazz music. It's not just one thing. It's very, It is. We have not done it justice by talking about it. You can't explain it.
No.
It's very. I cannot find a way. Like, you could say, hey, it kind of sounds like he's doing Winchester Cathedral there, but also it sounds like a Monty Python version of that. You know, and it's pre Monty Python. So, you know, it's very hard to do it justice.
And it's funny because you have sort of the sound that in America we might expect to hear in a Shakey's Pizza when they used to have musicians, you know, a banjo player, Dixie, you know, combined with Monty Python. It was just like, wow, well, isn't that interesting?
Have you met anybody from the band? Other than the radio interview?
Yeah, no, I haven't. No. I wish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I would like that.
Uh-huh. Did this lead you down other paths that we haven't talked about? Like, did the Bonzo Dog Pan lead you elsewhere in terms of, like, other comedy to seek out or even other music to seek out? Or is it its own thing?
It's sort of its own thing. I have, though, these wacky tastes that it has encouraged. And there are contemporary bands that have this kind of fun. I, in fact, had, what were they called? The spacemen from the planet so-and-so. On my radio show, I'd have bands that were usually young folk who had humor in their music, yet good musicianship combination. That thrills me.
Yeah. So,
like I said, you know, I'm a Frank Zappa fan.
Yeah. I'm surprised nobody's picked it for the show, honestly, because it's not strictly comedy, of course, but...
But there's so much irreverent humor, you know, from titties and beer to a Jewish princess to, you know, disco boy. There's comedy all through Frank's stuff.
Yeah.
Plus, incredible musicianship.
Yeah.
My friend Dave, he said when he auditioned for Frank, it was one of the hardest auditions he ever had.
Yeah.
And Frank, you know... He kept up, so he was offered the to be in the band. But shortly before Frank called him back, Ambrosia called him back. So Dave ended up in Ambrosia. But people that you meet, or you can even find, like Ruth Underwood, who played the vibes for Zappa, she'll talk about Frank and then demonstrate some of the complicated, you know, St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast xylophone solo for you. And it's insane! It's insane!
Yeah.
But so... fun.
Yeah.
It takes you on a trip and an adventure and has a story to tell as well. Frank's just, you know, as everyone knows, is legend. And I think his huge influences were the 12 atonal records that his father had in his collection. He was like, what is this complicated stuff? And he grew to understand it and bring it into his playing. And like the Bonzos, have this improvisational jazz sort of foundation.
Yeah.
And everyone had to be great musicians, whether they played an iron press or a washboard. You know, it just all these strange instruments came into play.
Is it, I don't know if since you not only are an artist, but you teach artists or you teach art, there is that thing that you're talking about with Frank Zappa where there's this desire to pick this stuff apart to figure it out. I mean, is there something like for acting, was it acting for you where you're just like, I want to pick out these bits and pieces? Or was there any one particular thing for you, or is it just that way for art for you?
Gosh.
Yeah. I know. It's a little complex and also a little muddled. But it's
but you know, it's inspiring though. Because I teach film acting and there really is no one technique that works for everyone.
Yeah.
So you need to have the ability to create the stimuli to get the emotional marks that a character may demand.
Yeah.
And for one person, that stimuli may come from Meisner fantasy charging. For someone else, it's got to be actions. And also another person, it takes sense memories or emotional recall. You know, you have the Stella Adler, you have the Lee Strasberg, you have the Meisner. Some people like the Asian martial art of acting that Suzuki has created, or some like Anne Bogart and Tina Landau's viewpoints version. There's all these different techniques that work externally, some are internally, some are very Zen oriented. You just let the character take over if the writing's good. And it's interesting because with great music, it's the same way. There's some who have taught themselves how to play and others who've spent 6 hours a day slaving and learning excruciatingly how to play their instruments. And then some who can only read the music and others who can improvise.
Right.
So it's, I see in your question this profundity for me to, I can't say that I have the ability to make all these magical things happen that these musicians can, but it is really fun to see, example, in my improvisational teachings that we just finished the semester up at Sonoma State, the students have revelations that, yes, I have to be truthful in how I'm feeling and start with that real energy rather than coming from something fake.
Sure.
I give them tools, hopefully, that they will learn not only just how to do improv, but take into their lives.
Sure, yeah.
And live a sort of deeper, whatever they do, mm-hmm. deepen and yeah. Boy, talk about tangent.
It's okay.
With big hungry tigers, table manners have no place.
Dear, 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 no, dear, dear, no, dear, dear, oh, dear, no.
After they have eaten you, they never say their grace.
Dear, 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 no, dear, dear, no, dear, dear, oh, dear, no.
Hunting tigers can be ripping fun. Like three blind mice see the hunters run.
Hunting tigers out in India. Out in, out in India. Yeah, yeah.
You all know how beastly tigers are. Out in, out in, out in India. They bite, they scratch, they make an awful fuss. It's no use stroking them and saying puss, puss, puss. No
hunting.
But you know what's funny is, like, I lied when I said I'm not going to ask you about Back to the Future, and here's why. We're talking about this band that is doing this very familiar thing. I think that most people, at least when they came out, you're familiar with that's the crap your parents listen to, right? So mm-hmm. this imitation thing. As something of an okay mimic myself, I mean, I would first have been aware of your work as having to imitate a pretty famous piece of film history. And you're doing it behind layers of makeup first, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, like, I don't know. Like, I do want to know where your brain was when you're doing that and, like, what the challenge was.
Well, first of all, I knew Crispin the year before he got the first Back to the Future film.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I did a film with him up at AFI, and I found him a very compelling, really mm-hmm. interesting actor.
Sure.
I loved it. And I got his number and tried to stay in touch. And when the first film came out, I was like, I know that guy. He's knocking it out of the park. He's really great. And as time progressed, followed his career through River's Edge and the Doors movie and all the other stuff, Dead Man. Great, great work. Usually high caliber almost everything I saw him in.
Yeah.
And then when I came into the opportunity to be his photo double stand-in, as I was told, I was thrilled. And I even called him. I said, you know, say a good word for me. I need to get my medical so my wife at the time could have our second kid,
mm-hmm.
get our medical coverage. And he never called back, and I was going for these prosthetic fittings, these basically mask, these makeup sessions. And when I had to do a screen test in the young George makeup, I was like, wow, I guess they're going to have us, him at one place and me at the other place
all
on
right.
the camera at the same time, because I wasn't told Jack.
Yeah.
And it was actually after the screen test was over, Zemeckis turned to the cinematographer Dean Cundey and says, what do you think, Dean? I think we got Crispin without the trouble. I was like, what? And then I heard from my makeup artist that Crispin was not coming back. And I was like, I couldn't fathom how they were going to do this film without him.
Yeah.
Now, if you look through history, there's always been imitators. Like Billy West was a famous Charlie Chaplin imitator.
Yeah.
Who, and I'm not talking about Billy West from Ren and Stimpy.
Billy West, holy
no,
shit.
I'm talking
I
about.
I did not know this
yeah, Billy West from, wow. I'm talking the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
He made Charlie Chaplin movies as the Tramp. And I don't know if Charlie sued him or not
this
for that.
Brand new to me. You're blowing
the studios
my mind.
May have. But there were other Chaplin imitators. Larry Simon, I think, did some Chaplin films. And if you look back, you know, Darren on Bewitched got replaced,
yeah.
and they got an actor who looked similar.
Sorry, yeah.
You know, the studios, either by death or other obligations or handcuffing with negotiations, whatever, have from time to time had to replace actors. And you can look at it as a tribute to that great work of that actor. You could look at it as cashing in
mm-hmm.
and abusing. Or you could look at it as to what they were in the Back to the Future cases. They had negotiations break down. You know, Crispin
yeah.
wanted script approval.
Wow. All right.
I don't think they were going to give that even to Michael J. Fox.
Sure. Yeah.
then I had heard he wanted the same money as Michael. And then they offered him, I think, $100,000, and he countered with $1 million. And as it went, you know, the first film was George's story. The second film was Marty's story, and the third film was Doc's story.
Yeah.
So George was kind of relegated to a support player.
Yeah.
And although had he come back for part three, he would have played Seamus. You know, Michael, as if Michael didn't have enough to do already.
Right.
They gave it to
right.
him. So it was odd. You know, at times I was like, am I a scab here? This is
right,
weird. Because
right.
the first time Michael saw me in the makeup, he was like, Crispin ain't going to like this. And often the director even referred to me as Crispin. And Leah at one point introduced me to her mom after we shot the film. And here's the actor who played Crispin. You know, it's, oh God, what am I doing?
Oh, Jesus.
Luckily, you know, this is 26 years ago now.
Of course, but
and the studio had announced all the original actors were coming back to reprise their roles, mm-hmm. and so they wanted to keep me a secret. And I could not forward my career by advertising. Everything that I tried to do to promote myself, the plug got pulled mysteriously on, or I got blocked, or took me more than 6 months just to get photos from the studio. So it was a nasty kind of scene, you know, thank you Spielberg and company. But, you know, it's kind of water under the bridge now. There's a lot of distance. And yet there's still this feud. It's very strange that Crispin and Bob Gale still have this feud, Hatfield and McCoys. And I'm like, you guys get over it.
Seriously.
Do some reunions, make it a fundraiser for Michael's charity.
Yeah.
Of course. And the fans would love it, too, to see him.
I would freak out.
With Tom Wilson, you know, with everyone from the cast doing some big tributes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how much longer Chris Lloyd's going to last.
Right,
and,
sure.
Francis Lee McCain, you know, we're all, you know, the young leads now are all in their late 50s.
Sure.
So it would be good to celebrate with the fans now in public and keep raising money for the Parkinson's Foundation.
Yeah, of course.
Because really, if it comes down to it, it's all about Michael.
Yeah.
They wanted Michael for Marty McFly from the day one, basically, but he wasn't available because of
family
ties.
That's right.
And so they forced Eric Stoltz down their throats
Eric
because
Stoltz.
He had just come off being a hit on Mask, you know.
Poor kid.
Yeah, but he was good. He's a good actor.
Oh,
he's a very good method actor, but he wasn't doing the comedy that they needed. Michael's got this great formula for comedy. It's just brilliant. One of the few times you ever see an actor call cut. I was like, wow. And, you know, generally as an acting coach, I tell my students, never cut yourself.
Right.
Never call cut.
Right.
There's gold to be mined after the dialogue ends. Yeah. And he said, cut, can we do it over? I didn't believe it myself. And when Michael, who knows his craft inside and out, says that, the director has no choice but say, absolutely, Michael, let's get it. Let's get it the way you want it.
Yeah.
You know, because he really is great. And Zemeckis is very smart. He's higher, competent talent. Both on your crew and your cast, mm-hmm. and just sit back and solve problems.
Of course, yeah. What did you do to, I mean, was it just, all right, I'm going to watch some stuff, or I'm just going to, how did you just do it? Did you just know the impression?
Well,
because it's not that simple. It's not as simple as, here's an algorithm, I've got the voice.
When I first started playing Stan Laurel at Universal Studios, if you went to Universal between 87 and 2001,
mm-hmm.
and you had your photo with Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, or Groucho Marx, mm-hmm. chances are it was with me.
That's great.
And I was in between TV and film roles,
mm-hmm.
and I got the opportunity to audition to play Stanley. And I remembered seeing Laurel and Hardy as a kid, but I didn't remember very well.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing everything very silly. I needed the work, though, and I don't remember if I wore my underwear on the outside or my bowler, I'm sure, was too big. Anyway, the actor playing Oliver Hardy knew my work from a production where I played Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet in Hollywood, and he says to the boss, he says, I know this guy, he's got talent, I'll train him.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 weeks, I was doing a passable Stan Laurel.
Awesome.
And through that, it opened such a great place for me of reverence for Stan Laurel's talent.
Mm-hmm.
Because he often not only wrote, but he also edited, he sometimes directed. Hal Roach would only give him one credit, and that would be the starring credit.
Sure.
But he was weaned on theater. I became friends with Tony Hawes, who was the grand poobah of the Sons of the Desert, Laurel and Hardy fan club that Chuck McCann and Jim McGeorge and Orson Bean and James McCabe. Anyway, they started this international fan club that's still thriving. And Lois Laurel, Stanley's daughter,
mm-hmm.
let me look through his scrapbooks.
Wow.
And there's a photo in there that I hope one day the public gets to see. It's magnificent. His father, Stanley Jefferson's father, was a theater producer, and he built the children a stage in the backyard. And there's a shot of Stanley, must be about 10 years old, directing his brothers and sisters on this stage. So he grew up with this amazing honing craft, and even stole his father's suit, tux, to perform the first time up in Ulverston or Lancashire, wherever. And his father, unbeknownst to Stanley, was in the audience. And, you know, really gave him a good speaking to afterwards, you know. What are you doing on the boards, lad? Anyway, so putting together Stan Laurel to do an accurate and respectful portrayal took a lot of doing and studying. Yeah. Then about a year later, because the actor, God bless him, the little Tunisian man who played Charlie Chaplin up at Universal for many years, who was a political hire, mm-hmm. just to get him away from Chasen's, I think, was just doing Charlie no great service. He had stolen a mime from Marine World, Marine Land's act, you know, tickling people behind the ear with a straw, and was in shorts and a bad, no makeup except a mustache, and... darken the eyebrows, and it was infuriating me because Charlie needed to be respected. So we finally got the managers up there to get this guy in makeup and a proper costume, and as Charlie got better, and then I put Chaplin together and would replace him on days off with other actors like Billy Scudder, who played Charlie for IBM for many years, and then put together doing Groucho, I even got a Groucho a Chico and a Harpo. And I remember one of our first big gigs was for City of Hope, a tribute to the Marx family, where Robert Marx, Zeppo's son, and Harpo's son Bill was on piano. Gilda, Robert's wife, was being honored. Anyway, we got incredible feedback from the Marx Brothers family.
That's awesome.
That was awesome. That was very nice. And in more recent years, I put a Three Stooges team together.
Wow.
As you can see, my hair is just right for playing Larry now. Mm-hmm. So we'll do these gigs that, you know, are basically party gigs or sometimes stage stuff. But through that work, I learned, to answer your question, such a long roundabout way.
Fascinating. I love this stuff.
How to try to find, as Michael Chekhov, who was one of Stanislavski's star students, his theory of acting is to find the character gesture.
Okay.
Find the essence of that character through a gesture. And so Crispin, you know, had this forward gravitational pull pulling him forward. Yeah. Hello, I'm leading with my forehead. And I have these gestures. And then the voice is a placement. Hey, you... Get your damn hand, Biff. Oh. You know, and so he has this very singular energy and feel and character gesture that is his essence. He has this stuff going on in his core that it took a while to get grounded, but it wasn't impossible to find. And that's why when I'm playing George age 17, I had found that stuff. And most people see George going to the car in the background and picking the fight with Biff again and kissing Lorraine on the dance floor. And I have that essence that Crispin does so well.
Yeah.
And I like to look at it as more of a tribute than a friggin' ripoff.
For sure.
People, you know, Crispin fans, God bless them. I am a fan too. But they hate me. It's terrible.
For the longest time.
I did a Reddit... Ask me anything.
Sorry.
And most of the folk were very lovely and friendly and asking about it. And other people were like, you piece of so-and-so. And I'm like, oh, brother.
Oh, my.
But, you know, it's and you're not alone. A lot of people didn't know. I still have people, I'd say about 35% of the folk out there that I meet at fan cons were like, you weren't George. And, oh, yeah, I was in 2 and 3.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it is what it is. It's kind of weird, and I'm very happy that I'm a part of the family, and they're really lovely people across the board. I don't care what Bob Gale or Crispin Glover say about each other. I think they're both lovely people.
Yeah.
They just, you know, are at each other, and I hope they get over it.
Is there any truth that Crispin Glover collected eyeballs at one point? That is the story Tom Wilson has told.
So I don't doubt it. Didn't he bring... I think he brought that collection on Letterman.
Did he really? Okay, there we go. That makes sense.
And I think there were glass eyeballs.
Okay. Well, that's
I don't
fine.
Think they were real ones.
I would say, because that would be a little strange.
Though that's his... Stranger. You know, if you look at his books, you know, the rat-catching books that he's sort of reinterpreted from the 19th century and... his music, you know, there's an album for your show.
Yeah, that's a good call. Yeah. That's a good
he's supposed to be walking. He's a kook. And, you know, he's, I don't pity him. He still whines a lot, but, you know, he's got a castle, I think, in Romania or somewhere. I think a home in Utah and probably still has an apartment in Hollywood. Anyway, he's had a great career, makes a lot of money because of my work. On the film, you know, he settled out of court when he said, it's not fair that you made another actor up to look like me and misled people and used my footage without giving me very much money.
Right.
So he got, you know, his $750,000, uh-huh. where I got maybe over the 26 years with residuals. I don't know if I got $100,000.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You know.
Well, all right. That's fun.
Yeah. I don't have to. Anyway, I celebrate... Actually, the fans and the movies. I mean, those are great stories.
And you're
and
doing
a lot of
great
fun.
Things with it, though. Like that's the only way to do it justice, I think. Because, you know, like, just performing is one thing. But, like, if you're actually doing something for charity, that's positive.
Yeah, I mean, I still have to put food on the table, so I can't give everything. But usually, every Comic-Con I go to, I try to give a good chunk back.
That's awesome.
To either Michael's charity or Wendy Jo's charity.
That's awesome.
We Spark.
Do you have... first of all, okay, let's talk about Tadpoles, and you should come back on and we'll talk about another album. We'll talk about I don't give a shit what we do. But what's a good reason to listen to Tadpoles if you haven't heard it before?
Oh, well, the fun. I'm the Urban Spaceman, of course. The pop hit on it is very catchy.
It really is.
And the satire and the politics and the social climb is referred to then in that one. Hunting Tigers Out in India is very... silly English fun. Shirts is irreverent, silly.
So good.
Yeah, it is a lot. Monster Bash, if you don't know the original, this is a good introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Jazz is jazzy. Tubas in the Moonlight, silly fun. The Laughing Blues.
Mm-hmm.
I was very happy to hear this tune because as you may gather, I'm an audiophile and mm-hmm. archivist of early sound. The actor who played Oliver Hardy used to collect cylinder records wherever we'd do appearances. I'd help him find cylinders. Oh. Finally, I was like, I think I'm going to start getting these a couple years into it.
Really?
And so I've amassed a nice collection of cylinder records. And a lot of the ones I lean towards are vaudeville and music hall, especially comedians. You know, have me back on them.
We'll
do a show on Marie Dressler. Yeah, I love Marie Dressler's stuff. Very. A lot of it, of course, is based in minstrelsy, which is derogatory now. But some of my favorite songs that come out of minstrelsy are laughing songs.
Uh-huh.
An actual known freed slave, George W. Johnson, late in his life, mm-hmm. recorded these great laughing songs. Now, they don't have titles that you're going to like.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really lovely, fun things. And they're all... you know, and they go on and this sort of thing. So Laughing Blues is a bit of a laughing song. And I have, you know, also discs of various Laughing Water and the OK Laughing Record. And the, you know, almost all the record labels would have their own laughing song. And then there's popular jocular Dr. Brown of Camden Town, which is a laughing song. I have all these laughing songs. I probably have 40 or 50 Jeez. Laughing songs in my collection.
Wow.
Spike Jones has a great laughing song.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many great ones. And so to hear the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, or Dada Band, have a laughing song was very rewarding for me. And that's on this record.
It's pretty fantastic. Like, you can't not laugh. Again, that's the whole point. But, I mean, that's just it. Like, it's wonderful.
And then, you know, some of the songs like By a Waterfall, you know... are kind of psychedelic. They even mention LSD in it. And Canyons of Your Mind is definitely psychedelic.
Uh-huh.
So it's great for the trippy, hippie culture that hopefully will come back and get people, you know, back into love instead of abusing immigrants.
That'd be nice.
I don't want to get too political here. But...
um, I think you can rest assured. Hopefully, most of my fans are big into peace. I would hope so. Do you have anything? Where can people find you online, if anywhere? And B, what do you have to promote? I don't know when this is coming out. It might be a while.
Well, I've got my website, jeffreyweisman.com, which is in desperate need of updating, at least on the news page. But you can see my different characters and everything I'm talking about, basically on one connection, one page or another, lookalikes or other characters or my teachings. Then I'm on Facebook. I have a fan page because my personal page has been at 5,000 for 5 years. And I have to unfriend someone to add someone.
Yeah.
I know almost all my 5,000 friends. And I check their status every day. Anyway, so I have the fan page there. And I have a Twitter account at J-E-F Weisman. And my Instagram is my name plus numbers. And I don't know it offhand. I'm still technologically challenged somewhat. But once again, you can find me and email me through the homepage of my website. I have a MySpace page still. Do you hear crickets? And there's also a film that I worked very hard on, a low-budget indie film that I'm rather proud of. I play a very depressed, epileptic widower who befriends an adolescent girl who's being abused in the foster care system and by the local gang. And it's like a modern-day Shakespearean tragedy. It's
sounds awesome.
It is pretty awesome. It's very, very heavy.
Yeah.
Called Savior of None. And that's currently just started streaming on Amazon.com.
There's that word heavy again. Sorry, I had to. I'm so sorry.
Why is it, what's so going on in the future? Is there a gravitational pull? Why is everything heavy? So there's Savior of None. I have a lovely part as a nefarious time traveler in a pilot for a TV series called The Traveler. So if that goes to series, cool special effects and really great team of folk that I'm working with on that. I've got various projects in development that I wish I could talk about.
Sure.
Have me back on. Maybe I can.
Yes.
Then.
Oh, yeah. That will absolutely happen. We got to talk about cylinders. Okay. Guys, thank you guys for listening. Thank you so much for doing this. This
sure,
is a
Jason.
Lot of fun. I know it took a while to put it together. But
nice to meet Jennifer.
You guys should go to... Oh my God, there's a bunch of crap. But I don't know when this is coming out. Just go to lookingforwardmovie.com. That's my all-improvised fake documentary.
I brought these other records that we didn't talk about, like Child's Garden of Grass.
I know.
Music for Casual Affairs. Mm-hmm. This is a very hard one to find.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one
before? I've seen the cover, but I've never actually
seen it. The Best of Marcel Marceau.
That is, I can't believe that exists.
And there's absolutely nothing on it.
That is great.
Anyway, I'll bring more records out of the archive.
Yeah. That'll be fun. Go to lookingforwardmovie.com. That is my improvised fake documentary that is going on through November. That's all I'm going to tell you to do. Do that. Go listen to the Dan and Jay's Comedy Hour podcast. And yeah, anyway, thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.